Welcome to episode 36 of the Thinking Poker Podcast in Somerville, Massachusetts. I'm Nate Mavis, and with me is Andrew Brokus. How's it going, Andrew?
Great. Once again, coming to you from Las Vegas, Nevada. Been out here for about a week and a half, which is, and I have another week and a half before I take my break and then return for the main event.
And if you hear a spring in Andrew's step, that's because he actually booked a winner yesterday.
That's right. I hear. I think I've played either 10 or 11, or it must be 10 days since I've been out here, and I finally booked a winner yesterday. I've only two of those days have been cash games, so I guess going 0 for 8 on tournaments isn't really such an anomalous outcome, although it certainly doesn't feel great in the moment. But I played cash yesterday, and I did a thing that you probably shouldn't do, but I really felt like psychologically I wanted to get a winning day under my belt out here. So I stuck around in a not very great game and did eventually manage to eke out about $200. So
very good.
Nice. That'll cover 1/7 of a tournament buy-in, 1/8 of a tournament buy-in.
It doesn't feel good. I've been where you are. I back in the day I was a horse in the World Series, and yeah, I went over for a while before I made the money. It doesn't feel good. I think I was better able to deal with it than most people, and I think you now are almost certainly better able to deal with it even than I was then, and sounds like it's not fun even for you.
No, although I will say, just having the opportunity, this podcast honestly is a big help in a couple of ways. I mean, one is it helps to beat back a little bit the isolation. Like, I'm kind of out here. There's a lot of people I know a little bit, or people I've never met in person before who I've had the opportunity to meet. And I know I was bragging on last week's show about all the free meal equity. I got another freebie yesterday, by the way.
Very nice.
I'm not really out here. Like, my girlfriend's not with me. I'm just staying in a condo by myself. I'm not like in a house with a bunch of other poker players or anything. So I think having the opportunity to, talk to a good poker friend such as you is good, both on that front in terms of just not feeling as isolated. And secondarily, the thing that's, I'm really at a point in my career where if I was just getting bad beat out of all these tournaments, I don't think it would really be that much of a bother to me. It's more that a lot of the losses have come in spots where, it's not as clear as when you get your money in good, it's kind of like, well, what else could I do? If the cards didn't fall my way, they didn't fall my way. But there's been a lot of spots where, I call a big river bet with a bluff catcher and turns out he wasn't bluffing, or, I put out a big bluff and turns out he had a hand that could call. And you don't really know in those cases whether you made a mistake or not. Like, will he really be bluffing 80% of the time and I'm just unlucky to run into one of the ones that he did? Or will he be folding to my bluff a lot of the time and I was unlucky to run into a set? Or does he only ever have a set when he gets to the river and he's never folding to a river bet? Like, that's the kind of stuff that eats at you a little bit more, because it kind of causes you to question things. You're like, well, am I actually playing well, or should I be changing up what I'm doing? So I think it's real valuable. I mean, in my case, to be able to bounce hands off of you, either on the podcast or sometimes when we talk about hands, even if we're not recording it, although we try not to waste our time like that. But I think that's good for anybody just to have a coach or a poker friend or somebody just to get some input on something, or poker forums are good for this, to get some kind of input that doesn't come from inside of your head, because a lot of the important stuff in poker you really can't evaluate just based on whether or not a play worked or whether or not you won a hand.
Yeah, well, first of all, that's very kind, and it makes me feel good, because one lingering feeling I have about this show is that I must get a lot more out of it than you do, just because you're a bit better and more successful at this game than I've been. So it's,
yeah, but I don't have any friends, so it's a good balance.
Oh, thank God. You mean live tournament experience? You mean what I have is live tournament experience that's valuable to Yeah, I also think the Thinking Poker community has been stepping up big. A lot of really good comments on your blog lately. Yeah. A lot of really good email to the show at podcast@thinkingpoker.net. I feel like really everyone around you has really been stepping up a little bit.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And the thing is, like, another thing that makes what you said such a pain with figuring out whether you should be bluff catching is that when you're wrong, it's often the case, or at least sometimes the case, that for that person you were drawing almost dead on that call. Like, when you're figuring, like, over the range of opponents, some of them are going to be people that you should always call against, and some of them will be people who will be bluffing sometimes, and then there's maybe if you're calling with a pure bluff catcher and it's some World Series event, like maybe 10 or 15 will be the sort of weekend warrior who is just never, ever, ever going to be bluffing in that spot. And you always have to, like, at least for me, I always think that if I were a little more perceptive or just a little bit better, or a little bit sharper or a little less hopeful or fearful, then I could have somehow sussed that out and learned.
There's always, especially for someone who's someone inexperienced at live poker, there's always that sense of, oh, was there some tell that I missed that a better, you know, a more experienced live player would have recognized that he blinked three times before he bet and therefore I should have folded, or just like that kind of stuff. You're like, oh, you know, could someone else have gotten away from this?
It's tough. And I mean, again, it's just totally different to the flush draw case. Like, a flush draw is always sometimes going to get there, yeah. Right? Like, sometimes bluff catches are never going to get there. That, you know, that was such a thing for me, because in live poker there are also these regional differences, and you haven't played poker on that side of the Mississippi for a while. I remember, you know, I cut my teeth out east at Foxwoods and then later at the Borgata, and the first time I went out west I didn't know what to prepare for, and especially the first time I went to the Commerce, like, you hear all these stories about how crazy and gambly it is, and you know, I was playing 2040. I was like, oh man, I just folded king high to the turn. Oh man, should I fold the king high on the turn? Maybe I should call. It's like there was a straight, you know, it's like, whoa, just calm down. It doesn't mean it's, yeah. So the trip, results, other than results, the trip's been okay. Some free meals, some.
Yeah, it's been good. You know, I've been continuing to meet interesting people, both at the table and people that I've made arrangements to meet because I, you know, had some connection to them, but in many cases I'd never met in person before. So that's always a really cool opportunity, and it provides a good break from potentially frustrating tournament situations. You know, I will say the one thing that I'm starting to notice a little bit more of, and this could easily be anomalous, but it could also be a matter of the summer progressing and people starting to get a little testier, is I have seen a little bit more kind of rudeness and conflict at the tables. And I think I was saying last week that I hadn't really seen much of that at all, and everyone had been pleasant. There's kind of two things that rub me. And one is certainly is people being rude to dealers. And I want to come back to that one in a second, because when we talked some with the dealer we had on the show last week. And you know, obviously, it's not a great feeling. You know, certainly, when you're an experienced dealer, it's annoying to be disrespected by people who don't actually even know what they're talking about. But I think too, I mean, I think there's reason to have a lot of sympathy for the inexperienced dealers. I mean, the WSOP wouldn't be here without them. There are not enough experienced dealers to meet the needs of the WSOP, and there are probably things that Caesars could be doing, and also the players could be doing, to have more experienced dealers out here. I mean, I've certainly upping the amount of money they receive is probably the single biggest factor, but there are probably other things that could be done to improve the quality of life of players. So it's not that this is an issue that shouldn't be talked about, but I mean, there really is a need for a lot of inexperienced dealers, and without them, the tournament wouldn't run. And it's not their fault that they're, I mean, inexperienced dealers are going to make mistakes, and they're not going to know what they're doing. I just don't think it's, even if it were their fault, being rude to them wouldn't necessarily be a good solution to that problem.
Yeah,
be appropriate.
That's right.
I think it's not fair to like to expect that inexperienced players aren't or inexperienced dealers aren't going to make mistakes. And if you really want to minimize the number of mistakes that are made both now and in the future, being polite about it is probably the best way to accomplish that, rather than being, you know, condescending or rude or anything like that. The second thing is rudeness towards amateur players, and I think there's kind of, and it's not necessarily something that I'm seeing directly, like directed towards them at the table, but I think a fair number of those people, especially if you're a name player, I mean, if you're someone whose name is widely recognized, at least among poker fans, or the kind of people who are going to be playing at a $1,500 WSOP event or something, there's a non-trivial chance that they're going to come across anything that you say on Twitter. And so when you're making fun of whether it's a specific thing that a person has done, or just the kinds of things that a certain type of amateur player likes to do, like make lame jokes at the table about chopping blinds, or just, I don't know, if there's this whole, I think you have a sense of what I'm talking about. There's this whole
absolutely.
World of things that kind of jaded pros. And I know we've done this on the show before. I'm not trying to say that, you know, that we're entirely blameless here, but these kind of jaded pros do to make fun of the things that, you know, amateur players who are just here to have a good time, like the things that they do that they enjoy doing, which might include joking around at the table in a way that you have heard a million times before or that you don't find very funny. And I think it's a challenge, but I think it's not the right thing to do to be making fun of them, because for a number of reasons, they're what make the WSOP great, both a fun experience and financially.
I mean, there's also a very big difference between drawing attention to the humorous contrast between how many times you've heard the joke and how many times they've heard the joke.
Yeah.
And acting like they're just the biggest annoyances in the world because they're repeating these lame jokes over and over again. Like, those are very different kinds of speech act, I think. Yeah. And no, it's sad. I think a lot of it really is just that it's not the first weekend anymore and people have bricked off for a while. You really get the 1,000-yard stare in the hallways and people coming to grips with the reality of big markup figures and things like that,
yeah.
Especially without online to fall back on in the same way. I think a lot of people are just, you know, confronting the fact that maybe their career is not going the way they want it to, or maybe that being a backed poker player is not the right kind of career for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and none of which excuses anything. But how about this? I would bet that what you're seeing is not just in your head, in part because opening weekend is second to main event weekend, or maybe more than main event weekend in terms of happy buzz in the Rio, sort of good times coming in. Yeah,
everyone's excited and there's still opportunity. Everyone has opportunity ahead of them. And then as the summer progresses, you know, only a small number of people actually have success under their belt.
I mean, I'm glad that when I was out there, I was living in a poker house and I had a lot of support, and no, it was really good. Just having people who would talk about hands all the time, and it was great. It was great. No, I definitely remember a lot of what you're describing. I've in fact been the fish being berated by at least two named pros in the World Series in my life. Each time I was like a little bit taken aback, but I wasn't like hugely offended either time. I mean, I came away thinking that they were dicks, but but I didn't think that I wanted to stop playing poker or anything, you know.
But you can imagine that some people probably do have that reaction, or they're like, well, I'm not going to go back to the WSOP anymore. I mean, people come specifically to play with players whose names they recognize. And that's kind of a crazy thing if you think about it, that people are showing up. Like, there are only so many cases where people are like, yeah, I really want to play poker for thousands of dollars against people I know are better than I am. I mean, that's a rare situation. And the one thing that they want to get out of it is enjoying the experience and maybe feeling like they have some level of camaraderie with you. Like, we're both poker players, even though you're a lot more successful at it than I am. And that's not an illusion to them. And to take that one thing away, which is the only thing that they're paying for, both that they're paying Caesars in the form of rake, and they're paying you in the form of the equity that they're giving up in the tournament. And the one thing that they want to get out of it is enjoying the experience.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it's obviously bad behavior, but at the same time, you know, what they end up getting is a real picture of what, you know, of like what poker can do to somebody sometimes, you know, if the conditions aren't right.
Yeah.
So
in terms of the rudeness to dealers, I had kind of three specific situations where this came up. And I think the more interesting thing to talk about actually is how these situations were handled rather than the way the person treated the dealer.
Yeah. But before you say that, can I disagree with one thing you said?
Yeah.
And I think you actually disagreed with it for yourself. It sounded like you claimed that the World Series has to have inexperienced dealers like at this level, and that counterfactual just seems to be false. Like, I think it's just false that if inexperienced dealers weren't there, then there wouldn't be a World Series. If those dealers, like if the worst 20% of dealers weren't there, then Caesars, realizing that it would be very bad to let those tables go undealt, would just raise prices, and then better dealers would come. And we have lots of anecdotal evidence about good dealers not going to the World Series and it being a pretty close choice just because they aren't getting paid enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not totally clear to me that it's necessary. I mean, given that conditions are what they are, at least the dealers who are trying reasonably hard are not to blame.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems false to me that it's like a necessary evil. I don't think it is.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I'll say this. If for the foreseeable future, if you show up at the WSOP, expect to encounter inexperienced dealers. Don't be surprised when it happens. And I mean, I think for the same reason, don't handle it badly when it happens. Just accept that that's going to be part of the experiences. You can think of this as the elite platform for poker, but you know, in truth, you're going to have some of the least elite dealers that you'll see all year.
And if you're playing the main event, it'll get better. For whatever it's worth, they do at least.
Yeah, they call throughout the
Yeah, they do. So if you're going out for the main event, you're probably going to get better dealers. Yeah, there are going to be a lot of... It's okay. I mean, the best kind of equilibrium is if you're at a table with a lot of people who know what they're doing. The dealer pitches the cards, the players run the game and tip the dealer, then the dealer pitches the cards for, you know, shovels boxes. Yeah, and that's how it goes.
That apparently is literally how they do it for Chinese poker. I was talking to a dealer at Aria about this yesterday, and she was saying when they spread Chinese poker there, it's not the dealer's responsibility to determine who wins the hand. Literally, all the dealer does is deal the cards, and then the players like figure it out amongst themselves.
Yeah, this is actually something. Randy on 2+2, he's like very experienced, very knowledgeable poker, you know, floor man, room manager, one of these guys. I'd love to have him on the show someday. And a point that he's made pretty frequently is that traditionally the higher you get, like the higher you go in poker, like as you raise the limits and as the players get more sophisticated, the dealer's job more and more devolves into pitch the cards, shut up, shuffle, shuffle, box, you know, riffle, riffle, box, riffle, pitch the cards, you know, etc.
Yeah. Well, I've got a couple examples where that kind of fell apart, even though, you know, what was required to be was somewhat minimal. So let me see which one of these I want to start with. I think maybe the best one to start with, this occurred in the $1,500 no limit tournament that I went somewhat deep in. I mean, it didn't cash in, but made it like almost to the end of the day. And as we were returning from dinner break, the player who was in the big blind was insistent that he had been in the big blind the previous hand and that the button was in the wrong place. And the way this works at dinner break is there's always a dealer who stays at the table while the players are gone, but it's not the same dealer. The dealers continue to rotate or to push each other. And so the dealer who was there when we go on break puts the button on top of the stack where it's supposed, this is how it's supposed to work. He puts it on top of the stack where it's supposed to be, and then none of the other dealers touch it. So the dealer who's sitting there when we return to the table is not the dealer who was there when we left. So he doesn't have any insight into the situation. He's just like, look, the button is where it is. I'm not authorized to move it, you know. And no one else at the table is sure. I mean, it was the last hand before dinner break. I actually had aces, but I didn't get much action with it. It was just like somebody limped, I raised, everyone folded and went to dinner. So it was not a significant hand. Neither of the players in the blinds actually played the hand. So just, I don't think anyone, you know, remembers an hour and a half later where exactly, whether the button was there or one spot over from there. And
I'm always the nit who remembers, by the way. This is never a problem when I'm at this table. Like, I have no experience in this. Like, but anyway, so the dealer is not the dealer who went there.
Yeah, this probably doesn't even count as a dealer error. I mean, there's a fair chance the player is just misremembering it or whatever. I mean, I will say, I'm convinced that he believes that he's right. I mean, I don't think he's just trying to shoot an angle here. Like, I'm convinced because he was pretty upset about this.
Yeah.
So he's convinced that he's been caused to pay the blind twice, and the floor is called over. The one thing I think the floor really could have handled differently here is that he was pretty dismissive of, he was just like, is there anyone here who can verify that? No. Okay. And like walked off. You know, I think even when your decision is clear as a floor person, I think there's a lot you can do to help a player accept that decision is the correct one without taking a lot more time. Just like even going through the motions of like actually investigating the situation or like explaining a little bit, you know, here's the policy. We have to have two other players at least who can verify it. And, you know, no one who thinks it's clearly wrong before we're going to address it. Just, you know, give them some indication that you're acting fairly. I think it'll really do a lot to help a player swallow a bitter pill. I mean, you're going to get rulings go against you. And I think the important thing is just feeling like you were treated fairly. And I mean, in this case, I think the floor did make the right decision. I think it was clear that that no one knew and there wasn't sufficient information to move the button. But I still think there was more the floor person could have done just to give this person the sense that he was being taken seriously.
Although, boy, what I wouldn't give for a poker world full of floor people who made the correct decision reliably, if a bit gruffly and briskly, then moved on. Like, I think the poker world needs more accuracy and less sort of customer service or whatever.
So this player goes on in that very hand. He I think calls a raise out of the big blind that he wouldn't have called had he not been in the big blind. Ends up flopping trips against a turned full house and loses not his entire stack but a pretty big pot. So now he's like really tilted that this is, you know, because he already thought he had to play the blind twice, and then he's concocting all these scenarios for how he, which is true. I mean, he would have more chips. This really was an error, and it hadn't occurred he would have more chips. I think it's important to see in these cases that although it doesn't feel random, I mean, it feels like a great injustice was done to you, but, you know, again, dealer errors are going to happen, and it truly is random in the sense that it could have happened to anyone. I mean, it sucks that he happened to be the guy that it happened to if it really did happen. but it could have happened to anyone. And focusing on this sense of injustice of, oh God, this, you know, this it was a small injustice, but now it's turned into a big injustice because I lost a big pot as a result of it, and everything would be different if only we had rotated the button in the correct way. I just think focusing on that, like especially after he lost that big pot, it may have even contributed to him losing that big pot. Yeah. And then after that, I mean, he was just clearly tilted and then went out, you know, not too much longer after that, and was, I'm sure, still convinced that that he was cheated out of the tournament.
Yeah, and I mean, can I put my knit hat on for a second? Who am I kidding? I always have my knit hat on. Whenever there's a break, unless I've been drinking so much coffee that I need to like run to the bathroom, or at least like walk as fast as I can without Rio's security guards getting mad at me for running, whenever I can, I do not leave the table until the hand is completely finished. I mean, more times than I can count, there have been three people sitting at a table for 5 minutes into a break, two people contesting a pot, and then me not in the pot, just staring at them because like I want to know what's happening and I'm entitled to stay at the table until the last hand is done. And that's information for me to get. And I want to do as well as I can in the tournament. And so I'm just not going to spend time walking around the hallways that I could spend gathering information, right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
But almost all dealers say, okay, you know, you push the pot, you push the button. I believe the standard sort of mnemonic device is push, push, pull when you're a dealer. Push the pot, push the button, pull the rake, or maybe one of those is pull. And yeah, so I mean, yeah, you see the dealer, you know, move the button, and then dealer office say, okay, and it's on here, and it's here when we get back. So every player has a chance to verify that, and everyone is complicit in it being in the wrong spot, including that guy, if it's in the wrong spot when he gets back from dinner. You know, I mean, just because you folded doesn't mean that you don't have, I mean, it doesn't mean that you aren't.
Right, he could have stuck around and made sure that the button moved.
Yeah, and just as he's foregoing the ability to gather the information and learn about what's going on and, you know, verify color-ups, I verify a lot of color-ups. Yeah, he's also passing on the chance to make sure the button's in the right spot. While I'm shocked that other people couldn't really remember, because I just don't know how that works. You know, I think, you know, he's partly to blame and he's got to get over it. And I think both of us have been in situations where, but for these weird little procedural things, we wouldn't have lost big pots. I know I can think of one that was actually very similar and involved a moving button in a different context. Yeah, and that's just tight. It's just part of the focus that goes into playing good poker, you know. Yeah. Like everybody has weird, you know, he could have just as easily not had the other guy turn the full house and won a nice pot. So
the second of these is clearly a dealer error, and it's one of these things. I mean, it results in a messy situation, and it's just, once the error has happened, there's going to be a messy situation no matter what. So I think it's an instance of, I mean, trying to complain afterwards like, this never should have happened, now the situation is messy, it's just pointless. Like it did happen, the situation is messy, and a decision has to be reached, you know, we have to do something. And again, I think it's a case where the decision probably, actually I shouldn't say that because I didn't hear, there was a lot of talk between a player who was complaining about this and the floor that I wasn't privy to hearing, so I don't know to what extent it was adequately explained to him. But what happened is, we're playing, this is in the 3K shootout. I think this wouldn't be as big of a deal if it weren't a shootout tournament, but because this is a tournament where you just play until one person is remaining at the table, and then that person takes all of the chips that he won at that table over to his new table when they do a new table redraw. So a player sat down at the wrong seat, and there is a process in place to prevent this from happening. When you sit down, you hand your receipt and photo identification to the dealer, and the dealer is supposed to verify that you are the person who is on whose name is on the receipt, and that you're sitting in the wrong seat. So this dealer failed to verify that the player was in the right seat, and it turned out he was in the proper seat at the wrong table. And he doesn't realize it. The dealer doesn't realize it. No one else gets to see his receipt to verify it. So it's really just on the two of them, and I think in particular on the dealer, to make sure that he's in the right place. And that didn't happen. So he plays for a couple of hands and actually manages to lose about half of his stack during that time. And then, and this also, this is part of what makes it tricky, because this guy was probably a player of below average skill for the field. Then a player of well above average skill for the field shows up at the table, and he presents a seat card and his photo identification to the dealer. And it turns out the source of the confusion is that someone is sitting in his seat. So it becomes clear what's happened, and the floor is called. And initially the floor, actually, well, maybe I'll just stop here and ask you, how do you think this situation should be resolved?
My first instinct was also the floor's first instinct. Sorry, I read your blog. I already know how some of these things go. So, but I think the player's got to move, just because one principle of good, secure poker regulations is that the dealer does not have the power to shift large amounts of money by doing one thing or another. So, for example, if the player has done nothing and the dealer says, oh, you just said I fold or whatever, like, that can't be automatic. And if the even if the dealer drops the deck into the muck, that can't mean that the hand is over and that, you know, a certain player wins. You just can't have dealers having the ability to shift thousands and thousands of dollars of equity just by making what may or may not be an innocent mistake. And of course, there aren't dealers who do this now, but that's because the rules are such that they can't do it, you know? So, like, as soon as dealers start being able to transfer tons of money from one person to another, then I think you'll get a lot shadier people being dealers. So the standard answer here is to move the player into the seat that he was assigned, because you don't want the dealer, for among other reasons, you don't want the dealer to have the ability to transfer a lot of equity like that. And you also don't want to have, you want to discourage as much as possible players from trying to take a free roll into a better seat, mm-hmm. you know, because if they have to move as soon as it's discovered, then, you know, there's a lower reward for trying to do that. So,
yeah, and if you do it more than once over the course of a series, people can start to get suspicious.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's got to be the standard answer. But of course, the fact that it's a shootout changes things considerably. By putting more chips on one table than another, then it's unfair in various ways to the people at the table. So I think in this case, you really just have to let it ride and give the new player, you know, give the good player the bad player seat and stick with it. And yeah, I think that's the lesser evil in this case.
The scenario that you're describing, there certainly exists the possibility of collusion between a player and a dealer to facilitate a player getting to sit at the seat, you know, the seat that he wants to sit at.
Yeah, but it's not very much in this case.
Exactly. Like, it requires it's a bit of a parlay that. Because, the dealer, I suppose you could just be, in theory, in collusion with a dealer, and you just have the option of either taking a seat at that dealer's table or at the table that you're assigned, just, like, knowing that somewhere in the room there's a dealer that you're in cahoots with. But, there's nothing a dealer can do to ensure that you know, he's assigned to a particular table. So you couldn't, I don't think, really plan that well in advance that, you know, this dealer is going to smuggle you onto a table that you don't belong at. Not to mention that, I started to say it's going to be discovered once the player shows up, but I guess one of those things that you're only going to be able to get away with. I mean, if a dealer is consistently doing that, he's going to be fired very quickly. So yeah. You know, it's not something that you're going to be able to do repeatedly or to have a large influence on the game. And so this one player is very upset now that this good player is going to be at his table when he wasn't, quote, supposed to be there. And he is just, you know, continually, like, going back and forth, missing hands at the table to, like, keep going back over to the floor. And eventually, like, Jack Effel, the director of the WSOP, is called in, and you know, he's talking to the player also. And the guy's just not dropping this. And it's clear that they're not going to change their decision at this point. Like, they end up, after initially deciding they should put the players in the seats to which they were assigned, they quickly reverse that decision before a hand has been played. And they make what I think is the correct decision of leaving the player in the seat where he incorrectly sat and just playing things out. So, like, several hands have been played. They're clearly not going to change the decision again. And then the kid is just continuing to argue the point, which, you know, in addition to wasting time, again, he's tilting himself. You know, he's getting worked up about something that's no longer within his control, and he's clearly not going to play well once he feels like there's been this great injustice that's been done. And, although he's, because, you know, now he's saying, like, well, I can just go around to every single table and try to sit there and try to sit there and try to sit there, but in practice that's not going to happen. There are a number of reasons why that's not actually going to happen, and, you know, among other things, this kind of free roll requires either a dealer being actively in cahoots with you, or a dealer failing to properly verify your card, which, I mean, it's conceivable it did happen, but it's not going to happen that often. I just think the risk for abuse of this is quite low compared to the damage that's done by not having the proper number of chips at a shootout table.
Yeah, that's right. And just to be explicit, for people who haven't read the blog, so the reason it's so unfair to do it the standard way in this case is because if you do put the people in their assigned seats, then you have one table having to play only a poor player with half a stack. And so they have to win fewer chips to win their shootout table. And everybody will be equal at the next round, at least usually. I guess, you know, so they don't equalize the chips. But just for ICM reasons, that's a big benefit. You know, they have to accumulate fewer chips to get to the payout. And then for the people at the first table, they have to win more chips to win the table, which is also unfair. Like, raging about it. So raging about it impolitely is the wrong thing to do. But the World Series has been wrong before. And it's pretty clear to me, well, at least I strongly suspect suspect that the only reason that they stopped using marked cards about 5 years ago is because certain people, among them Harry Demetriou, just would not give it up. And they complained and complained and complained and complained and complained. And I'm grateful to them for that. Like, you know, it's one of these things where it's a fine line where on the one hand, many, especially, I mean, hopefully the force of reason would be enough for him to see that this was the right ruling. But there really are going to be wrong rulings sometimes, and you really have to stick your ground. I mean, this is your money that you're playing for, and you have a right to see that it's, you know, that disputes are adjudicated fairly. And really what a lot of the staff wants is for the problem to go away and not always for the problem to be resolved correctly. So I have to say I'm grateful for people who won't let it go sometimes.
Yeah, that's fair. Although I think it matters. I don't know that while you're playing is the best time to be trying to address it if it's not something that's going to be changed. Like, because we're talking about two different things. I mean, one, there's a question of are they going to reverse that decision in the moment? Like, are they going to reverse it in this case versus are they going to change the way it's handled going forwards? And I think if I understand you correctly, you're mostly talking about changing things going forwards. Like, even in a circumstance where they're clearly not going to reverse their decision in this case, it can still be worth continuing to argue the point in order to get them to change the way this sort of thing is handled in the future.
Well, yeah. And frankly, if they're not going to do that, sometimes you just have to make their life difficult so that, like, you just pain them into it. And also, like, wasn't there a big pot last year in, I think, the 50K Players Championship where it took over an hour and, like, they had to call and get Jack Effel out of bed or something because he was taking the evening off, and they actually did change it? Like, they said, no, this is our final decision. And one of the players involved, I think, said, like, screw you, this is wrong, and I paid $50,000 for this tournament. No. And then he ended up, I think, actually getting it changed. I got to go back and look at this. But, you know, I mean, he was right. you got to do that sometimes, I think. I mean, I've never done it. But especially when there were marked cards or whatever, right. Like, I was loud about it. And I kept on fighting up the chain. And when people told me to sit down and shut up, I really didn't, you know? Like, the game belongs to the players. So, I mean, this was not the right thing to do. And this person was fighting for the wrong cause anyway. But, you know, I got to say I have some sympathy with the idea that just because, like, two people have ruled one way doesn't mean that they're right, and it doesn't mean that you have to be quiet about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it does require an ability to, like, I think so many people just get so focused on what they want to happen that they're not really thinking about it. You know, like, because, I mean, there's a big difference between, like, continuing to push on something that's clearly wrong, like marked cards, versus continuing to push on something that was a close decision that didn't go your way. And, you know, I think it's important to be a little self-reflective and be able to recognize the difference between a gross injustice and a tough decision that you don't agree with.
Yeah, definitely. And this is also, as you just said, like a textbook case of people's beliefs about what is right being clouded by their desires for something to be right.
I was going to say that my third example is an even more clear instance of this.
Yeah. Oh, can I
yeah, that, that's say why, one that's story? That's why I want you to finish your comment first.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, it's a simple thing, and it doesn't involve me making a huge stink and demanding, like, the supervisor's supervisor, but it was something where everybody thought I was wrong, but I actually wasn't. You know, this was just a cash game at the Win about 5 years ago, and it was the turn, I think, and it was a five-handed pot, pretty big pot, and I bet, and then the next guy was thinking, and while he was thinking, you know, the person after him folded, and then a couple seconds later, the person after him folded. Then the guy directly to my left raised, and you know, I think three people folded.
So that's a great deal of information for him to have to know that he's only going to be raising into one person instead of four.
Yeah. So I said, whoa, that's not a raise. He didn't protect his action, and nobody, none of the players and not the dealer had any idea what I meant by protecting your action. The general consensus was like, well, that's too bad for you. Never mind. Half the table had no idea why what had just happened was sort of unfair to me. And the other half thought, well, it's not his fault if other people folded. Like, he can't control their actions, right? And he shouldn't be punished for something they do. But the correct view is you are responsible for speaking up when you see action happening out of turn, especially when it doesn't happen rapid fire. As soon as somebody acts out of turn to your left, just start yelling. Well, don't start yelling, but say, hey, whoa. You know, just speak up and do something. I mean, it's one of your duties as a poker player is to keep track of the, I mean, if you want the chance to raise, you have to protect your action. That's something you have to do to preserve that option. And he didn't do that. So everybody thought I was crazy. I said, whoa, dealer, that's not a raise. He didn't protect his action. And the dealer said, some sort of polite version of like, what on earth are you talking about? And eventually we got the supervisor over and he said, oh, you know, what happened? Yeah. That's just a call. Okay.
Yeah. Well, good for you for pushing when you were in. Just make sure you're right if you're going to push.
Yeah. I mean, eventually if you're wrong, you're going to lose the pot and you'll just be arguing to a brick wall. But
my point is that you also be continuing to upset yourself. Like, I mean, I think being able to let go of things is important in a tournament in a number of ways. And often it's letting go of a bad beat or letting go of a bad play or something. But I think also letting go of a sense of injustice from a decision that is behind you, being able to recognize when a decision should be behind you is important to preserve your ability to do well in the tournament going forwards.
Yeah, it's also a sign. Like, if you're playing a tournament, you should be aware of just how much luck you need to get and how many crazy random things are affecting the results all the time and what, like, a bizarre and kind of sick lottery you're playing. and for something like that to come up should just be, like, you know, one more butterfly flapping the wings. As in your third story. Okay.
So this last one, and I think it's significant here that this hand is a bad beat, because I think it contributes to the person's sense of injustice in the way he handles the situation. But it, basically, it's like it's a three-bet pot. The flop comes down king, 10, 5 or something like that. A guy with ace king bets, another guy shoves, and the guy with ace king actually tanks a little bit before calling, which I think was reasonable based on the situation. But he calls and the other guy has ace queen and then nails the gut shot. So the guy is already upset now that he's lost with ace king versus the top pair top kicker versus a gut shot, and he loses a quite big pot. And then the dealer accidentally pushes the pot to the player who had the ace king, who actually lost the pot. She pushes it to him in a way that commingles the chips in the pot with the chips in this player's stack. And so, you know, quickly everyone is like, whoa, 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 hey, stop. But, you know, damage has been done and the chips are commingled. So now instantly there's some question of like, what are we going to do here? And of course she instantly calls over the floor and is generally feeling very sheepish. So the first thing that goes wrong in this situation is everyone at the table, myself excluded, is shouting their opinions on the situation at the floor.
Which is very simple when you get down to it. Like, it's not like a subtle, it's not like, it's pretty obvious what's gone wrong here. Like, you don't need to hear it from 9 different people.
This is something that I don't understand why it seems to happen a lot, and I never really see the floors like take charge of the situation, and like, because they often pose questions to the whole table. You know, they'll just come over and be like, okay, so what happened? And then you got like 9 people trying to tell you what happened, and I really think the person, you know, I think should be more clear about zeroing in on one person, presumably the dealer, and, you know, getting everyone else to be quiet and get the information that they need from that one person. But instantly you just have, you know, people shouting suggestions and their idea of how many chips they think this person had when the hand started. And just like, I don't even understand the logic of thinking that that's going to be helpful in any way for you to be like, I think that guy had 12K. Like, there may come a point where where people are asked what they think people had. But prior to that point, you shouting out a number is just not contributing anything to the situation. So, I mean, first off, when this stuff is happening at the table and when things start to turn into a cluster, it's really in your interest and everyone's interest for it to be less of a clusterfuck, means not just needlessly interjecting your opinion, when it hasn't been asked for. And, you know, it's one thing to jump in when you see what seems like a bad decision to you being made, but when a decision hasn't even been made yet, I think it's a little soon for you to start jumping in with your opinion. I think this is particularly true if you are, again, like a name player, because I think there have been instances of floor people who, you know, I mean, they do legitimately know less about the rules probably than you know, some player who's been playing for like 20 years or something. But I think it's an unfortunate situation when a player like that is able to sway a floor person's opinion simply by force of their personality or by the credibility that comes along with their name when that's a person who has an interest in the way the decision is handled.
Yeah, that's right. Although, if it's a trusted person, then, I mean, this often happens in cash games where there's just the guy who's known to be fair-minded and is also known to know everything about the rules, and everybody's happy to defer to him. And you know.
Well, that everybody's happy is an important criterion. I mean, when there's a disagreement at the table, I think the floor should the Florida needs to make their decision first, and then if it seems to be a wrong decision, players can interject at that point. But I don't think that a player, even if he's the most famous, knowledgeable poker player in the world, should be trying to influence a Florida person's decision before he's had a chance to evaluate the situation on his own first.
And also, like, this case is very easy. You figure out how much was in the pot, and then you give that amount to the guy who should have won. Like, it may be hard to figure out how much should be in the pot, but the ruling, the substance of the ruling is pretty simple. After that, it's just make your best estimate.
So. Yeah, and then that was essentially what ended up happening, was that they kind of asked each player, how much do you believe you had when you started the hand? How much do you believe you had when you started the hand? And then sorted out the pot. And in a way, like, to kind of, based on where the chips were lying, sort of made a first approximation of what may have been the pot. And then counted up what that would have made the players starting stacks, and it turned out that was reasonably close to the numbers that these players had given for what they believed their starting stacks to be. And then he said, can both of you live with this, or is this does that seem approximately enough correct, which seems to me the best way that you could handle that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit surprising that nobody remembers. So you described the players having had a decision. He didn't ask for a count or anything?
Nope. I mean, a lot of things could have happened to make this a more clear situation, but it happened not to be. And it's, again, one of those cases where, I mean, it feels like a bad outcome where you're like, well, some chips may well have been, in fact, definitely one of these players did not get exactly the right number of chips, or both of them did not get exactly the right number of chips they were supposed to get. And that's a pretty bad outcome for a situation like this. But that's going to happen once the mistake is made. Like, once the pot is intermingled with the stack, it's you're going to end up with an imperfect outcome. So I think trying to focus in on that and being like, well, something wrong. I mean, yeah, something wrong has gone on here, but we have to deal with that and move forwards.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. It's also strange, like, and trying to picture how that could happen. And like, yeah, maybe I'm just being like a teacher's pet nit here, but like, first off, I always know how much I have in my stack. And second off, I often, like, when the pot's pushed to me, I always know exactly which chips are part of the pot and which are part of my stack. Maybe it's just a matter of table geometry at the Rio or something. But
yeah, I mean, probably the dealer was not supposed to push the pot as far as she did, or all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Another argument for stacking your chips neatly, I guess. Yeah, but maybe it's just a failure of imagination.
What I found to be the craziest part of this situation is that this is a hand that takes place between an amateur player and a player who I'm pretty sure is a professional. He was a young guy and he was from Germany, and I think those two things together add up to him probably not being an amateur. Like, an older person from Germany might be here just as on a lark, and a younger person from the U.S. might be here on a lark. I think it's not that likely that like a 23-year-old from Germany is just kind of coming over here because he's a fan of poker. I think he's probably a pretty serious player. And he is, I don't know how to put it, insistent. I mean, he asks several times, he asks several different people whether he doesn't actually get to keep the pot because it was passed to him accidentally. And at first he just kind of says to the dealer, hey, be careful. Technically I get to keep that pot, and maybe next time I will, or something sort of like that. And I'm like, okay, well, he's kind of tilted, I'm like, but then like when the floor is called over, he asks the floor, he's like, so don't I technically get to keep the pot because it was passed to me? And then like a higher floor person is called over, and he asked that person too. He's like, let me ask you a question. Isn't that pot mine? And each time he gets more certain about it when he asks, And I just like, I mean, I really try hard not to be judgmental about this stuff. And I know he has this sense that the pot was supposed to belong to him anyway, because the guy made a bad shove and he got it in way ahead and it was a bad beat. And I mean, that's probably part of why he feels like it's like okay for him to try to claim the pot in the circumstance. But it seemed like such a blatantly scummy thing to do. It was, if that were the rule that was on the books, I still think I would argue you'd be out of line to try to claim that pot.
Certainly the third time you would be. Yeah, I kind of like Leo's comment about this, which is that there's a very good chance this person actually holds a JD in something. Yeah, I mean, that's just crazy. There's just no way that's I mean, saying that, my other hypothesis is that it actually is a rule in his home game or whatever, or in his like casino where the rules aren't very good. It's just a terrible, terrible rule for a million reasons. One of which I've already discussed this episode, which is that it's just bad for everybody, including the dealer, if the dealer can transfer lots of money from one person to another easily. Yeah, that's crazy. Be red, be red, be red, be red, be red, be red.
We've got some follow-up here from our staking discussion that we had on episode 34, and this is coming to us from a regular blog commenter and podcast feedbacker, Pie Farmer.
Also very good on Twitter. Follow him.
Someone referred to you as the official Thinking Poker cheerleader. I really think Pie Farmer is the original Twitter cheerleader for Thinking Poker.
Yeah.
you're an imposter, Nate.
Because you've chosen your Twitter name to be at Thinking Poker, sometimes people say at Thinking Poker when they mean you, Andrew Brokaw, and sometimes they say it when they mean Thinking Poker, the franchise,
or
Thinking Poker, the podcast. So even though I may be the Russell Wood is definitely the Thinking Poker franchise cheerleader. Russell, yeah. Yeah, he likes us and he's awesome. And you should follow him on Twitter and read what he writes. He's a smart guy.
And we're about to read one of the things that he wrote. And this is some feedback on our discussion of how the marketplace works on 2+2. I don't know if it's worth trying to summarize that original discussion, but if you're curious about it, you can listen to it on episode 34 of the show. Pie Farmer says, the staking marketplace is simply immature. It will become more structured as poker continues to grow and to be accepted. And that should reduce markup as it becomes easier and safer for players to access capital. I expect it to ultimately end up similar to private investments like real estate or hedge funds, where a player sells 100% of his action in exchange for a salary that compensates him for his time and effort, plus a portion of all of his profits, perhaps 10 or 20%, to incentivize good play. This would be handled via written agreements and contracts. This is probably similar to how many individual backing deals work today, except that there would be no makeup. The player gives up some upside in exchange for a salary and no makeup. If you think of staking as hiring skill and decision-making, then staking someone is analogous to hiring that person. But in the traditional employment model, the employer advertises and the job candidates vie to be hired. Does this ever happen in staking, where someone with money offers to stake and then chooses from those who reply? So the literal
answer... A lot of good questions there.
Yeah, I was going to say that the only one of these that I really feel that qualified to comment upon, and I hope that you have more substantive things to say about this, but I can tell you that the literal answer to that final question is yes, it does, particularly when there's a big tournament like the Sunday Million is a real common one for this, or especially when there's a big, like when they do one of those anniversary Sunday Millions where they guarantee $2 million or there's going to be 10,000 player fields and things, just the kind of these unique opportunities that are not super expensive. So it doesn't happen as much with the WSOP main event because the buy-in is so high. But for tournaments with a relatively low buy-in where there might be a lot of people who would have the potential to be plus EV or people want an extra sweat, they want an opportunity to invest more money in these like super juicy but really high variance tournaments, I think you will see people put up a thread that's just like, I'm looking to put 10 people into this tournament, you know, and you know, send here's the information I want and then I'll comb through and pick 10. That kind of thing does happen, particularly when big unique opportunities like that roll along.
Yeah, I have very fond memories of an afternoon in Baltimore. An afternoon, sunny outside, I was lounging, and I get an instant message. Hey, do you want to play this $500 tournament online for a 25% free roll? I said, yes. You know, so I start, you know, playing, run up a little bit of a stack, everything's good. You know, I start to feel warm and fuzzy because this person obviously has so much faith in my brilliant play. And then I notice that there's some guarantee that hadn't been met. There's like a 40% overlay in the prize pool. Now it all makes sense. But yeah, this does happen. Didn't Marvin Rettenmeyer do this in the marketplace forum on 2+2 this year? He told people to send him their resumes, and then he would be doing some World Series staking.
I wouldn't be surprised. I didn't hear about it, but it sounds possible.
I think that happened. Yeah, these things happen. And you know, sometimes it's a little more informal where word just gets around that person X is looking for horses. And sometimes it's quite explicit and quite out in the open where somebody just makes a post or puts out word or whatever. I'm not sure that it'll ever get to the sort of quote-unquote straight world or square world model of drawing a salary and then having small incentives, just because for a lot of reasons. First, it's actually hard to align incentives for a lot of reasons, mostly having to do with the marginal utility of money. Even if, you know, you're both getting, even if the player's percentage is a portion of, is like a constant fraction of what the backer gets. And even if there are no makeup issues sort of providing perverse incentives, there are still marginal utility issues that often cause issues here. And also things like fame get involved where the player has extra incentive maybe to make a final table or win. But the other thing is that poker players really love the variance, and a lot of people just won't want to draw a salary, will be happier with higher quote-unquote commissions or whatever in exchange for a lower salary. And it's been like that in poker as long as I can remember. And it's not totally clear to me that economic, there's this phenomenon, which is that the poker world, the hiring practices and variance reduction practices happen differently in the poker world as they do in the straight world, or to how they do in the straight world. And explanation one is that there's an economic evolution and that poker will evolve to these sort of lower variance for the player models and drawing a salary model. And it's just sort of inevitable, and the marketplace will simply mature. I'm not sure. I think that has to be part of it, but I'm not sure that a big part of the explanation isn't poker players just love action. You know, like several times I can remember people trying to form coalitions where you had to be a completely trusted person. You had to have a sterling reputation. You would get together and you would combine bankrolls effectively once the cards were on their backs. So at the end of the month, you get together with your poker tracker databases and you see who is winning and losing money in all-in situations, and then you would equalize it among the group. And this would cost zero, and this would be done in a way that it costs zero EV, and it only decreases variance. So from a bankroll growth perspective, it is strictly good for everybody involved. As far as I can tell, nobody ever did that. People just wanted the sweat. I mean, obviously, you have to have a lot of trust, and there's a certain, you know, taxation can get tricky. There are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of genuine reasons not to do that.
That kept it from happening.
I don't think so either. Yeah, I think, you know, these things are just different. And a lot of people who are playing poker tournaments want the big score.
It's gambling. I mean, people knowingly give up money in order to have variance all the time. That's what casinos are built on. People are consciously taking negative EV, high variance decisions.
Yeah, I mean, one hopes so. Like, otherwise, there are more serious ethical problems with casinos than are usually. I mean, that's the good case, right? Is when people are knowingly just enjoying the gamble and they understand and are, you know.
I'm just saying we know that happens. I mean, it's
yes.
There certainly exists some group of casino players who are aware that it's negative EV and simply enjoy the rush of gambling.
And I hope it's most of them.
Yeah, keep hoping. But that happens in poker also. I mean, I actually remember a thread that was started in the high stakes MTT forum, I believe. And I believe the person who started the thread was in earnest, although he got obviously a lot of trolley responses. But he said, how much of an hourly rate reduction would you accept? How much would your hourly rate have to be increased if there were no variance in the game? And I think he earnestly believed that the variance was like a part of what people enjoyed. And of course, like most people's responses were like, you know, you should be asking how much would we pay a reduction, and you know, I might be willing to pay up to like a 25 or 30% reduction in my hourly rate if it meant I was never going to have to deal with variance again. Like a lot of people were claiming that they were willing to be quite risk averse in that regard, but maybe his question wasn't such a foolish one.
And I mean, I'm not different from this. I'm a bit nitty about these things, but you know, when I'm in a big pot with a made hand against a draw or something, you know, there's part of me that just enjoys the sweat. And there's at least one promotion in Las Vegas that I haven't done this year where I'll have a chance to play a little bit of video poker with positive expectation. And yeah, part of me is, you know, although I would rather just cash out my EV now, there's part of me that'll definitely have fun seeing if I make a flush or something like that. So yeah, no, I know the feeling, but yeah, so I do wonder if Pie Farmer's question here is really, if Pie Farmer's prediction is 100% correct. I think we'll see things move a little more in that direction, but maybe not as far as Pie Farmer thinks it will.
I don't think it's completely unheard of, the situation that he describes, where someone might just be getting 10 to 20% with no makeup. I don't think that's entirely unheard of. I'm sure that arrangement has existed before.
Oh, I'm quite sure it has. I'm entirely sure that it's not unheard of. So it's been heard and done many times.
So thanks for the comment, Pie Farmer. I always appreciate your contributions to the show. And others who have comments, send them to us, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. We've We've got a heavy dose of strategy for you on the show today, but if you want even more strategy, if you want to see videos of top players walking you hand by hand through tournament victories, then you want Tournament Poker Edge. I've got a new series of videos going up on TPE now. Those focus on late game play with an emphasis on stealing and restealing dynamics. When is the right time to raise a weak hand preflop just to steal the blinds and antes? When is the right time to re-raise a guy whom you suspect is just trying to steal the blinds and antes? My new series takes you hand by hand through a deep run that I made in a WCoop event, and you'll get a lot of analysis on how I approach those kind of decisions in real situations that arose at the table in the WCoop tournament. You will find that series exclusively at tournamentpokeredge.com.
Excellent.
Our first strategy hand comes to us all the way from Botswana. This is...
Wait, really? That's awesome. Wait, yeah. are we sure about this?
He had a plausible story. It would be an odd thing for him to make up. I did not IP check Nick in Botswana.
We're huge in Botswana.
Botswana poker community is all over the show.
That's great. That's really great.
It's actually plausible because there probably isn't a large Botswana poker community, and Nick is probably an integral part of it. So there's a
we actually are huge in
the Botswana poker community.
I mean, this is maybe just a vain desire, but I really want to know everywhere that we're listened to, because people everywhere just visit any casino, especially a place like the Commerce. All walks of life and every background everywhere. Everybody loves to gamble, not just Californians. Like there's poker just about everywhere, and there's internet just about everywhere. And so I think that people are listening to us in a lot of places, and I'm curious where all those places are.
Yeah, if you're from some crazy place, let us know about it. Even if it doesn't seem crazy to you because you live there, but you know, if it's a place that we're going to be like, oh, whoa, we got somebody listening to us in X, you know, let us know. This is very exciting for us.
Yeah, I sort of cringe at the thought of two white American guys sitting around describing other places as crazy. Yeah, if it's a place that
you know what I meant.
We apologize for offending everybody. But if it's some place that's maybe we won't have a lot of experience with, we're really curious about it.
So Nick, maybe we'll also have some apologies to make to the Botswana poker community. Nick says, yes. Our game here is really terrible, with a nice mix of bad play you find in 1-2 live play, but much more extreme. Just imagine taking the 5 or 6 worst players you've ever experienced at low limit, I think he means small stakes, no limit poker, over a lifetime of play and putting them all in the same game, mixed in with a few competent players. We have a few horribly weak type players, but the most common mistake, unsurprisingly, is loose passive play. There's tons of limping and limp calling with no positional awareness and with marginal hands. In these games, I find raising with small and medium pocket pairs to be largely counterproductive, as in most cases you can expect between 2 to 5 callers even when putting in a pretty big raise. Plus, set mining is ridiculously profitable. So in my mind, limping with small pairs is far superior in most situations. However, more recently I have realized that this limping has actually unbalanced my raising range heavily towards big card hands. So when I raise and there is a super ragged flop, I have less confidence in my c-bets because those flops miss my range so badly. In my particular game, I know this is leveling myself, as most of my opponents don't even know what range or balancing means. Although some of the better players I have noticed start to be highly suspicious of my c-bets on these flops, even if they couldn't articulate why exactly. But my more general question is, at what point or what situations does balance become more important than choosing the most profitable strategy? I suppose it becomes more and more important as you play with people regularly, but I'm really trying to figure out how much I should worry about it when playing at a casino with decent but not great players.
This is really good question. Really good question. Can I give a short answer first? Because I think we both have a lot of things to say about a lot of parts of this question.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Here's a quick guideline. So if you strongly suspect that your opponents aren't really going to catch on to what you do for a long time, don't worry about it until you have some evidence that they might be catching on. So if you think, oh, maybe I should, you know, worry about balancing my range now so that they don't start exploiting me, you know, one thing you can do is just play in the exploitive way until you start to have hard evidence that you might be getting counter-exploited. Then start worrying about it and maybe sort of prepare away from the table for how you're going to fix these sort of counter-exploitive leaks that you have. But until then, just pound and pound and pound and pound and pound until you actually think that you're being counter-exploited.
100% agree. Yeah. And I also agree with Nick that the way he's describing like wanting to set mine with small and medium pocket pairs in extremely loose games is very wise. I think that is a good exploitive adaptation for him to make to the kind of game that he's describing, because I mean, the problem with playing small or medium pairs unimproved in a raised pot is that your opponents are relatively unlikely to make mistakes, right? I mean, if you have a hand like 5-5 and you're up against a hand, even in a heads-up pot, you're up against a hand like 10-8. The 10-8 is generally going to fold your continuation bet when it misses and call your continuation bet when it hits. And you know, what that means is that your the 10-8 is going to play correctly against you post flop, especially in a game where your c-bets are very rarely going to be successful when you're getting called by five or six people pre-flop, and small medium pocket pairs have such poor equity when they're called by a pair that's bigger than they are. I think they're very poor continuation betting candidates generally. So I think just trying to set mind them in a game like this is certainly the way you would like to play. And the question is just whether that's opening you up to exploitation in other parts of your game, or even in that strategy. Like, the thing I would actually be more concerned about here is not that people are realizing I don't have small pairs when I do raise under the gun, but rather that when I limp and call, people are able to put me on exactly a small pair, and therefore, you know, are reluctant to stack off if I do show interest after the flop. They kind of know that I must have hit a set. That's the thing I'd be more worried about personally.
Yeah, this is something we've talked about on the show before, and I generally agree with that, but I do think there are important qualifications to be made, which is that sometimes you set mine by raising, so to speak. If you think that everybody's going to call your raise, then you want the pot pre-flop to be approximately the smallest amount such that you can get stacks in a reasonable amount of the time after the flop. So if it's a 1-2 game and you're playing 500 deep with at least a couple other players, and it goes limp, 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 limp to you on the button with two fives, I think you should raise there for several reasons, one of which is that you want a huge pot if you hit a set, not merely a big one. Yeah, so another thing to talk about here is that Nick says, some of the better players I've noticed start to be highly suspicious of my c-bets on these flops, even if they couldn't articulate why exactly. And they might not even know what range or balancing means. And there's a danger here of thinking that your opponents have no way of understanding what you're doing if they aren't highly conversant with terms like range or balancing. Like, I think they could articulate why they're suspicious of your c-bets on those boards. It's because you raise with big cards and small cards flopped, so you probably don't have anything to hit the flop.
Like, I've seen exactly, you know, from a huge fish in a 2-5 game at Foxwoods, like, years ago, before even I think a lot of good players would have understood this concept or been able to articulate it in those terms. And he was really a very, very weak player. Even for that time, he was a weak player. But there was a time when he check raised like a tight aggressive player on a small flop, and the guy folded, and then the weak player showed his bluff, and he said, "You only play big cards. Me, you know, I play little cards." That's it. I mean, that was the essence of the bluff, and it did work, and he did have a reason for it, and he wasn't. I mean, and that is even really kind of what balance means. Is, I mean, the guy was unbalanced if he only plays big cards, and he wouldn't have used the term balance, but he essentially articulated what it meant, and he knew how to exploit it, which was raise him when small cards come out.
Yeah, I mean, also like that. There's an awareness of capped ranges there. Like, you say, you know, I play small cards. So, yeah, like, you know, the best hands are in his range and not the other guys. Yeah. Did you ever read any of those old books of Bob Chiafone's where he actually suggests thinking in terms of a playing zone where cards from 9 through ace are part of the playing zone? And a good way to evaluate a flop is by noticing how many of the flop cards are in the playing zone and then thinking about who was the raiser and who wasn't, which guys are most likely to have cards in the playing zone and to react accordingly.
I haven't read that, although I think I've made some videos that employed a similar conceptual frame.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, the big card, small card distinction is a very well understood, even by players who don't worry too much about having perfectly unexploitably balanced ranges. So I think there's a good lesson here about which things casual players understand, even when they don't understand the advanced concepts. You know, I mean, everybody worries about flush draws. Everybody can see that a flush draw is up there. And I think also a lot of people, I mean, everybody knows what a big blind special is. And a lot of people in the big blind even try to represent big blind specials, you know, and that's because people do have some awareness.
That was one of my earliest aha moments in poker. I remember back in the days when I was playing like $5 or $10 rebuys or something, there would be times in like a limped pot where the flop would come like deuce, deuce, nine, or maybe even like a min raised pot or something. The flop would come deuce, deuce, nine. And I'd be like, I'm a lot more likely to have a deuce than the guy who min raised or than someone who open limped, and then maybe I'll try to represent it. And I mean, that was sort of in the days when like min check raising and betting the turn would really represent a lot of strength to somebody. And I do remember getting away with a couple bluffs like that. And this was not a time when I was like a real sophisticated poker player, but that was like one of my first forays into this world of thinking about like ranges and what you're representing and capped ranges and all that kind of stuff.
And I definitely remember. I think a lot of people had sort of aha moments like that. I can remember some pots where it was way before I was thinking thinking about like planning ahead in terms of representing things, but pot where I bet and somebody raised and it was pretty clear he had a good hand and I called with a straight draw and then I missed my straight draw and then I saw the other guy check and sort of look scared or whatever and then I was about to check behind and then I realized, oh wait, that was a flush card. And I actually do have a draw. He pretty obviously has a big pair. Like, why don't I just bet a lot? Like, and see, it's like, oh, yeah. It would be totally false to say that I had, you know, given myself virtual outs or that I was, you know, cleverly choosing a range with different kinds of, you know, mixing my draws up in the same range. I just thought, like, huh, I should check behind. Oh, wait a minute. Why is he so, oh, okay.
I had a,
well, I guess I bet.
I had a very similar moment where there were two flush draws on the board and I had one of them and the other one came in on the river. And so it just sort of occurred to me, I was like, hey, I could represent that other one, except that it was a three-way pot and then the third guy in the pot had the other flush draw.
Yeah.
So I kind of fucked myself on that one because I was like, all in! And he was like, I have that flush. So I probably could have thought that through a little more thoroughly. I was doing a good job of thinking about the range of the guy who had been driving the action versus my own, but I had not factored in the range of the third guy in the pot who had also been quietly calling alongside me.
Yeah, I'm going to do some name dropping here. That reminds me a lot of a conversation I had in 2003 with Vanessa Selbst, who, you know, we had just started playing Omaha in our home game, and you know, we were just chatting over sandwiches after the game. And she said, yeah, you know, the thing with Omaha is you can have a perfect read for the hand somebody has, and then you can try to run a bluff. But then they might have the hand you're representing also.
That's always
fun. They have four cards. I mean, of course, it was some like much more intelligent version of that. But yeah.
That's always been one of my big frustrations in Omaha, because I feel like hand reading is such a big part of my game in No Limit Hold'em. And yeah, it's just, I mean, I know you can do it in Omaha and I'm not entirely incapable of it, but that kind of thing frustrates me for sure. But yeah, so we've got it pretty far off the topic of Nick's question here. I would also say, I think that there are some better ways of addressing this problem than trying to play your small. Like, if this strategy is working for you in terms of small pairs, and your problem is really just, how can I deal with people bluffing me or not believing my C bets on low card flops, I think you have a number of other options besides just, you know, trying to start raising with your small pairs the same way you are with your ace king or something. A couple of them are that you can look for opportunities to rebluff when you have good draws. When a small board is like 8-6 deuce and you have two over cards with a flush draw, you can shove over a raise if you think there's a chance someone is just raising you because they don't believe you. I mean, you're actually probably better off shoving there with that hand than you are shoving with like pocket nines or something, where, you know, if you're wrong, you're King Jack of Hearts is going to have outs, which the pocket nines may not have. If you think the guy's raising range is mostly going to be like sets and better over pairs, then your nines are in pretty bad shape there. So you can think about like what might constitute a good rebluffing range. You can also raise other sorts of hands that connect with that board that aren't small pairs, suited connectors being the most obvious instance. So if you're concerned that like your under the gun range right now consists only of Broadway cards because you're not raising small pairs, well, you can add a 6-7 suited into your under the gun raising range, and then your range will be at least a little bit less vulnerable. Your opponents will probably still be correct to assume that you usually miss a small card board, but they'll be less correct than they were before you were putting 6-7 suited in your range. And if you show up with 6-7 suited once or twice, that might even actually, you know, change that assumption on their part.
Yeah. And even if they're still correct to make that assumption about you, you've at least turned that 6-7 suited from a $0 hand if you fold it into a winning hand if you play it, because playing 6-7 suited when people put you on big cards is going to be profitable.
Yeah, fair point.
At least for that hand, you know. So that's at least you can at least milk the fact that you have a high card heavy range, even if you can't dispel the other people's view that you do have that range.
And I do want to say finally, in terms of this discussion of whether or not it's how much balance matters when you're dealing with people who you do or don't play with regularly or something, the really important factor here is that you have a reason, you have something that you're trying to exploit, right? You believe that set mining is a good exploitive adaptation that you can make to deal in this game. And it sounds like it is. I mean, I think that is how I would probably advise you to play the small pairs in this game. In this case, you have an idea of a mistake that your opponents are making that you are trying to exploit. When you don't have that idea, if you're in a situation where you literally have no idea how your opponents play, then your objective should be to be balanced or to try to be balanced precisely because you don't have any idea how to exploit them. I mean, you have if you decided you wanted to play exploitively, how would you do that if you didn't know how your opponents played. So I think there's a sense in which balance is actually more important when you're dealing with people you don't play with regularly, if you have no idea what kind of exploitive assumption you could make about them. In practice, I think you usually do have an idea. I mean, even if you run into a random person shows up at your Botswanan poker game who you've never played against before, you might be able to make some assumptions about the kinds of people who live in Botswana and play poker. I mean, you know, you have a better idea what those people are like than I do. You might be able to make some assumptions about them that would enable you to start playing an exploitive strategy from the get-go. But if someone literally came in and you were like, I have no idea how this guy is going to play. I don't know if he's going to be very tight or very loose at flop. Then you would strive to be balanced simply because you wouldn't have any other idea what to do.
Seconded.
I was curious if you were gone or if you didn't agree or what. I think a very good question. Hopefully we haven't rambled too much about it. I know we've answered a lot of questions. Hopefully one of them was yours, Nick.
Yeah, here's a sort of just like a commentary. It's you know, it's a bit like the great medieval philosophers who would just produce very long commentaries on the ancient texts. We've just talked about his question for a while and we began by answering it. So we've answered it and we've talked about it. We've discoursed upon it. So now we can move on to the next one.
And this one actually comes from you, if you want to describe the hand.
Oh, excellent. You chose one of my hands. That's Andrew chose the hands this episode. Okay, so this is a hand. It took place a while ago, but you know, in the modern era of poker, I would say, you know, within the last year, but not very recently. 2-5 game, 2 limps to me on the button, and I over limp with 8-7 offsuit. Small blind completes, and the big blind checks. Big blind is an annoyed regular.
That was my flop favorite part of the hand history, by the way. An annoyed regular.
It's a common type. Flop is ace jack 4. Checks to me, and everybody looks pretty bored with the hand. I bet 15.
This is a bread and butter situation, by the way. You limp behind on the button and no one shows any interest in the pot, so you stab at it. I think for a live poker player who's accustomed to playing like multi-way limped pots, this is a bread and butter spot. Just in case people are confused why you're betting here with 8-7, I think this is a very clear bet.
I bet 15, yes. And small blind folds. The big blind looks at me, then he picks up some raising chips, and then he finally just calls. And I immediately suspect he was planning a semi-bluff. And the other two fold quickly. Now there's 55 minus rake, so about 50 in the pot for the turn.
Sorry to keep interrupting you, but can I ask what was the basis for you saying that you thought he was planning a semi-bluff?
So I thought he kind of chickened out by calling, and I thought that he thought that I was full of it. He was the sort of regular who likes to be able to justify his actions after the fact. Like, there are a lot of people who just won't bluff with a hand like 9-6 here. You know, a lot of people really do only bluff when they have a hand that they can tell a story about. So it seemed to me that he had more than a pure bluff. Like, he obviously thought that I was full of it, but he had some reason to call also. And I guess it felt to me that he was still playing his hand. He wasn't just playing the fact that I had nothing. I thought that he was still, in some relevant sense, playing the strength of his hand in some respect. But I also thought that he had no pair, because he checked as if there was no choice whether to bet or not, and he just seemed very weak to me. So it was some indistinct sense that he was still playing his hand, is how I would want to say it. So that's why I thought he had a semi-bluff.
Yeah, and I would also say, just to distinguish between a semi-bluff and like a monster hand that he was choosing not to raise here, I think a lot of that just comes down to there aren't very many monster hands that he would have. I mean, aces and jacks he's probably raising pre-flop, maybe even ace jack. So the number of hands that he's going to consider good enough to check raise for value here are probably relatively slim. So if you see that he was considering a raise and he ended up calling, I think there's a pretty good chance that raise was going to be a bluff or semi-bluff as opposed to a value raise.
Yeah, and if memory serves, I had seen this person raise with ace king in a limp pot out of the blind, and which is almost always correct, of course, but he showed absolutely no sense that it was like near the bottom of his raising range or that he was worried he would miss the flop or anything. Like, ace king was like an auto raise for him. So I think that hands like ace king, ace queen, you know, maybe even ace 10 or something, you know, like, certainly ace 10 crushes my range here. But yeah, so I think there are very few value raising hands, both that get to the flop this way and that check like that. So yes, so there's 55 minus rake, so there's 50 in the pot for the turn, which pairs the jack. So it's abundantly clear nobody has anything. So ace jack 4 jack. The big blind has 200 or so left. I cover, and he leads out for 30. Okay, and I've got 8-7 still. Yeah, so he's got nothing. So given the flop read, I don't think folding is an option. like I have nothing, but he just doesn't have anything ever here. So folding's out of the question. Most of his value hands are unlikely given the flop read. As I wrote into the podcast, most of his value hands are unlikely given the reads I have, and many are even less likely given that he's betting without the initiative when the jack pairs. Perhaps he could have a four, but first, I doubt he'd go for raising chips with that hand very often on the flop, and two, hell, I have nine outs against that hand, plus ways to win without improving. I go on to write, I could raise now, but I think I better represent at least a pair by just calling. Perhaps river aggression will look like a busted straight draw, but he could also think I'd fold my gut shots to this bet. Also, so the reason that's important is that on the river, I'll be able to represent value because he, I think, will plausibly think that I'm going to fold my Broadway and maybe wheel gut shots to this bet and certainly not call with them. Also, many busted straight draws are better than the hands I'll be targeting with a bluff either now or on the river. So even if he does put me on a busted straight draw, if I shove the river, then that's still likely to be better than the hand he's bluffing with.
And I don't really see him. I mean, even if he's like doubtful, like let's say that he has King 10. I don't necessarily think this is the spot where I'm going to expect a like not particularly sophisticated 2-5 rig to like check and hear you with, certainly with like queen high, let alone king high. I mean, I just think even if your line doesn't make that much sense to him, if he checks the river and you bet, there's a pretty decent chance he's not going to call you with a lot of the kinds of hands he would have to call you with to make bluffing with seven high unprofitable.
So, oh, finally, also my final justification for calling the turn with eight high was also if I have the choice between putting in money now or later for an unusual read-based play, it's often nice to wait for later to gather more physical information. And that's not something to live by or anything, but it's a nice small consideration, I think.
Yeah, I do that a lot. Like if I kind of have a choice between pulling the trigger immediately or deferring it, I like to defer and get some corroboration on my read before I decide that I want to, especially when it's a real heavily read-based play, especially, it's nice to get some corroboration before you put a lot of money into the pot.
So the river came in eight, which is in some sense boring. So I made a pair and he bet 40. And again, it's boring. I made a pair. I just called. he gave the bluffing shrug, and I turned over my hand, and he got angry.
Yeah.
Again, memory is fuzzy. This hand was not played very recently.
I would really love a transcript of the conversation that followed.
How you call the turn? How you call the turn? Like,
he's already an annoyed regular, and that was before he got called by eight high no draw on the turn.
I like to think I'm not an ego player, but yeah, it felt good. So our correspondent, that is me, goes on to write, I wasn't sure whether to call or raise on certain rivers. Obviously, I could fold if I changed my mind about what was going on. But what if it came a queen or something and he bet out? It would be very hard for him to be betting a Broadway hand. Wouldn't he check call with a pair of queens if he ran into one? And I had a strong feeling that he was considering a semi-bluff on the flop. That leaves wheel gut shots because there was no flush draw. So in some sense, I have an argument for just calling. And I'm a little bit worried that that's just fancy pants syndrome where I want to make a fancy play for no reason when I should obviously just jam. On other rivers, I go on to the right, I probably just need to jam, both because he could be bluffing a Broadway draw and because sometimes my read can be wrong, that he's semi-bluffing, and he can really show up with jack six or whatever. And I'm curious about So what do you think of that?
I mean, I think other than the badass factor of correctly calling the river with eight high, which don't get me wrong, there's a significant badass factor attached to that. And I might be a little tempted to do it just so I could say that like I had correctly called the river with eight high before. But yeah, I think this seems like much better as a raise than a call on the river. I mean, given how confident I am that he has nothing and how bad my own hand is, I can just imagine too many scenarios where you call and lose anyway for any number of the random reasons that you gave, or maybe he's bluffing with pocket twos for no reason. Or I could just see a lot of things that could potentially go wrong versus, I think it's so unlikely that he can call a raise on the river. I don't even know there would have to be a jam as opposed to a min raise. But
I mean, do you really see 2-5 regs call on the flop with two people left to act with 10 high nothing on an ace jack 4 flop? Like, when, I mean, like, really float out of position with, like, pure no pair, no draw, nothing.
No. this is a rainbow board, I take it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, I would love calling you with 8 high. Okay, if you told me this hand ended with you calling with 8 high, and I believed you, which would be questionable, that would be pretty badass.
Well, first of all, I would never lie. And second, like, again, maybe I just love. I don't think I have fancy play syndrome, but I do. I was a little bit disappointed when I made a pair. I'm not going to lie. I was a little bit disappointed. Pot wasn't that big, and I kind of just wanted to be the hero. But, like, really, if it comes to queen and he bets, like, he could have king 10. He could have run into it, but I think he would often check with the queen.
You're starting to sell me on calling.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because it's just that awesome. I don't know. Yeah. I think this would have been a calling spot with 8-7. Also, and again, fuzzy memories, but I did sometime, you know, like after he got like really angry and started yelling for a while, after a while he said, how do you call the turn? And I said, well, did I have the best hand on the turn? And he didn't deny it. He just yelled at me some more. Okay. Like, which is different. That's a different response. He did not deny it. That's very important. He said like, what do you think? Or yeah. I mean like later he said he had queen 10, but I don't know. I think that's telling. So I think I might have just had the best hand all along. Call for value on the turn.
I don't want to go off too far on a brag tangent because I've got one of those coming up with our next hand anyway. But I ran a bluff somewhat like the one that we're describing here last night. This is actually one of those hands. I mentioned yesterday's winning session being kind of nice, just like psychologically to say like, hey, I actually won one day when I was out here. But part of it was that I did really feel like I had to fight for the win. Like it wasn't like I just got run over by the deck. I ran two pretty big bluffs and this was one of them that helped me to get back into the black. So it was a limped pot and the flop came 10-7-4 and I had 9-8. So I had the open-ended straight draw. I think it was only three ways. And so we checked.
You said limp pot.
Yeah, limp pot. So it checked around to the cutoff, who bet 30. This is a 5-10 game. So he potted it, and I made it 90, and then he called. And the turn was another 10, which I thought was really going to hurt my chances of successfully firing another barrel, yep. which was my plan on most turn cards. The 10 didn't seem like a very good one. So I checked with the intention of probably having to give up if he bet or, you know, maybe calling a small bet. And he checked behind, which I felt pretty good about. And I thought there was a chance he might even have the same hand that I have. And the river comes a 3. So final board is 10-10-7-3-3. And I decided that he wasn't going to fold any pair if I bet, but that if I checked, he would probably bluff if he did actually have 9-8, and he also might bet fold a pair to a check raise. So I checked, he bet 100, I raised to 250, and he folded.
Very nice, very nice.
Seemed a little similar to this one, where both people, like, neither person believed the other, but I got to the river with 9 high and needed to do something about that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, sometimes check raising is the only way to win the pot. That's
Anyway, on to the proper brag here.
Nice answer. I'm tapping the table if you don't know. I don't know if the noise is coming through.
So this is another, I don't know, this is really more just a statement I want to make about tournament poker. Well, I'll be curious to hear if you disagree with the way I played this, but I think it's kind of a clear decision. This is from a $1,600 deep stack event at the Venetian. I've actually been quite tight, but I started the tournament off. We started with 20,000 chips, and on like the fourth hand of the tournament, I 3-bet and 3-barreled and was down to 9K immediately after that. So I'd been caught in a very large bluff quite early in the tournament, and I just didn't have many chips, and it turned out the table was pretty active, and I had actually been quite quiet. But I think between the fact that the table generally had been real active, so people were in a like nobody ever has anything kind of mindset, and also just, you know, that I did show down one big bluff, I think even though I'd been playing tight, I don't know that I'm necessarily going to be perceived that way. The relevant villains in this hand, under the gun, is a tightish recreational player, and he has an open limping range. So when he raises under the gun, as he's going to do in this hand, that's significant. Just if you know that a person open limps and then they choose to open raise, well, you have the information that, you know, this is a hand like they're limping some hands that other people might be open raising, and therefore you can narrow their raising range, you know, a little bit more. Under the gun +1 is also on the tight side, but I think he's just got a little more tricky little more tricky in him. So come back to the action in a moment. And then the button is a, I mean, I call him a tag. He's definitely a recreational player, and I don't think he was really that good. But you know, he just believes in playing strong hands strongly. He doesn't play that many hands. When he does have a hand, he wants to win the pot. Even more so than like getting value from his hand, he just like wants to make sure that he wins when he has aces or whatever. So he's actually re-raised a couple of times, like maybe more than anyone else at the table. They've always been like on the big side for what you would think of as like a reasonable re-raise size. He's always showed down big hands, and I think he's just been getting hit by the deck. But he even to the point where he's sort of overvaluing some of these hands. So the blinds are 100, 200. The average stack at this point is probably 30K, but I only have 8K. Under the gun, the player I was saying who has a limping range, he opens to 525. Under the gun plus one calls, and the player on the button makes it 2,000. And I'm sitting in the small blind with ace-king offsuit. Any question here about what we ought to do, Nate?
I think it's a clear decision, although I think it's fairly close in terms of EV. I think it is a close but clear fold.
Yeah, and you know, you're saying that like with regard to chip EV, right? Not with regard to like tournament EV?
Or am I? Yes. Absolutely, yes.
So I mean,
the
fact that it's close, you know, ignoring the fact that this is a tournament and these are the last of my chips, I think is enough to make it a clear fold once you recognize that that also is the case. And that this is really not a particularly tough table. I mean, despite the fact that it has not been going well for me, I think my expectation at the table is pretty good. And 8,000 chips is 40 big blinds. And this is the main reason I wanted to talk about this hand, aside from like giving myself a pat on the back for not just like tilt shoving it with ace king. I mean, this is a scenario where I can see a lot of people getting tilted. You lose a lot of chips really early in the tournament, and then you start questioning the play, and you're like, well, maybe I shouldn't have fired that third barrel in the river, maybe I shouldn't have three bet ace jack suited, and you're kind of already kicking yourself a little bit or questioning yourself a little bit. You've been playing short stacked, a couple of other things haven't been going right for you. All the recipes are there for frustration, and you feel like you started with 20,000 chips, now the average is 30, you only have 8, you feel like you're so far behind everyone else, you feel like your stack is so short because it's dwindled from where it was. You know, in fact, you have 40 big blinds here. You have plenty of room to do most of the things that you're ever going to do in a tournament hand. You no longer have room to three bet triple barrel, but you might be better off without that play in your arsenal anyway, it seems.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, how are you going to re-raise and then triple barrel into a set if you only have 40 big blinds? I don't know about that.
And I think they just making just being like, oh fuck it, I have ace king, and you know, I think a lot of people shove here with a death wish, you know, or they shove here just kind of saying like, oh, I'm probably not going to win this tournament anyway. I'm going to have to try to get lucky at this point because I'm low. And in some sense, it's true that you're going to have to get lucky. I mean, obviously, you're not that likely to win the tournament when you have 25% of the average stack. But you know, there's no reason to reduce your chances even further by making negative EV plays. And I think it's worth thinking about what these people's ranges are before you stick it in there with ace king offsuit. And the really important thing here is that nobody's calling this shove with ace queen. So the button is never folding, and no one is calling here with ace queen. I think those two factors, those are like the two most important factors here, in my opinion. Because you know, if the best case scenario here is that you run into the button who also holds ace king or who holds like pocket tens or something, and you manage to get a coin flip against him with a little bit of overlay, not even a ton of overlay really, but you know, that's like the best case scenario. The button is overvaluing hands to the point where like jacks or tens probably are in his range here, so it's not like he's just guaranteed to have kings or something. But you've still got an under the gun raiser and an under the gun plus one caller, both of whom it's plausible that they could show up with aces or kings. I think there's just way too many ways for you to run into a hand that has you in bad shape. There's really no way for you to put money in here as a favorite, and it's really just a question of like, do you want to coin flip for your last 40 big blinds? I think you definitely shouldn't if you are interested in maximizing your equity in the tournament, but I think a lot of people would because they're feeling desperate or feeling unlucky or feeling sorry for themselves or you know, and now they're like, oh, now I have to fold ace king pre-flop. So this is a spot where I thought it was folding was obviously the right play. And even, I mean, the reason I'm saying this is because I felt these things in myself, you know, like there was definitely a part of me that was like, oh fuck it, just put the ace king in there and go play cash games. This is probably one of the cases where it's helpful that I'm playing partially on other people's money, because I might be a little more inclined to do that if it were my money. I fold here, and I think that's the right thing to do.
This is just a basic point of behavioral economics, is that the pain difference between 20K and 8K is so much bigger than the pain difference between 8K and zero that people will be highly inclined to gamble it up to get back to even. because it's actually not that much worse psychologically for a lot of people just to go bust and be done. So,
and that's why we're talking about this, and is so that I can get a pat on the back and nullify that pain difference by getting some pleasure out of making a good fold and being told that I made a good fold.
Yes, I praise you. I praise you. Excellent. Our listeners doubtless are also praising you as they listen to this. So, that's very good. And you're right. It's just so important, especially, say, in the main event where you can lose a huge pot the first hand of the tournament and still have like 200 big blinds left. There's just so much you can do to get back into it. And it can be really hard when you're in pain to take a deep breath and actually think about the ranges. You know, it's why the best solution is just not to feel the pain in the first place. You know, it's or the old Caro aphorism, don't try to get even, you already are even.
Hey, it's Andrew here. I just realized that when Nate and I discussed this, the final hand from our strategy section, we didn't actually give you the results. Obviously, they're not terribly relevant, but I know some of you are curious to hear these sorts of things. What ended up happening, I folded. The under-the-gun player actually 4-bet to 6K. The button just called. One more bet went into the pot on a rag flop, and then they checked it down. The under-the-gun player had jacks, and the player on the – or sorry, the under-the-gun player had jacks, and the player on the button had queens. I think that the 4-bet with jacks is a pretty bad idea on the under-the-gun player's part. I think much better for him just to call on that spot. What most likely would have happened if I had shoved, I probably would have gotten all in against both of them, which would be a very profitable spot, even to get all in against one of them, especially if it was under the gun, although it's hard to imagine the button folding queens. But to get into a race here, like, I wouldn't fold here if I knew with 100% certainty that it was a guaranteed race, because I think there's enough money in the pot to warrant racing here, like ace-king versus queens, if I knew that was going to be the outcome. So the main reason for folding here really is the risk of running into kings and aces, with the knowledge that the best possible upside is getting this like marginally profitable race against queens or jacks. I suppose if you know that you can get it all in preflop against both jacks and queens, that's a quite good outcome for you, but I don't think that's a particularly likely outcome. Chasing